You are listening to They Came From the North, a decidedly Canadian view of your favorite directors. This week's episode, episode 6, we'll be looking at the storied career of comedy pseudo-legend John Landis.
Woo.
I'm your host for tonight, John Mercer. With me, as usual, my East Coast compatriot, Mr. Steve Power.
Hello.
Representing Canada's fine francophone population, in Montreal, I believe, Mr. Gabriel Gerard.
Bonjour.
And representing the rest of the goddamn country, from a little bit of everywhere, including your backyard, Mr. Andrew Forbes.
I'm very confused.
That was the best intro ever.
I should be doing this all the time.
You should.
So I just figured, you know, guys, this week we'd get the ball rolling right away. And so, first a little bio on Mr. Landis.
Man, you got to do it in your best Strombo voice. Here's the bio.
I'm not doing a Strombo voice. I don't have nearly the facial piercings to pull that off. And by nearly, I mean any. And I have one tattoo. It's a big one, but it's just one.
Your Newfoundland's boyfriend, are you, John?
Yeah. So, John Landis got his start in Tinseltown, working as a mailboy at 20th Century Fox. He attained his first substantial work as a gopher for the assistant director on Kelly's Heroes in 1969. Soon took over that same position after the original assistant director was sent home by the studio following a nervous breakdown. You know, after working with Clint Eastwood and Telly Savalas and Donald Sutherland and the height of cocaine, I'd probably have a nervous breakdown, too. Between 60...
But Landis could handle it.
That's because his beard acts as a filter. Between 69 and 79, Landis worked a variety of positions and odd jobs in and around the European film scene, getting involved in such films as Once Upon a Time in the West, El Condor, Red Sun, which is awesome, by the way, and even an uncredited writing gig on 1977's James Bond movie, The Spy Who Loved Me. While his directorial debut in 1973 with the pseudo-comedy monster movie send-off Schlock was less than successful, leading to a period where the director professes to have parked a lot of cars, Landis was set to explode onto the scene as one of the seminal comedy directors of the post-Jaws and Star Wars era. Between 1977 and 1983, he delivered a string of commercially and critically successful movies, mostly comedies, including The Kentucky Fried Movie, National Lampoon's Animal House, The Blues Brothers, which was the first and one of the very few successful films to be born from the wildly popular Saturday Night Live, then An American Werewolf in London, and Trading Places. It was also during this period that perhaps the most widely seen of Landis' work was debuted, not on a movie theater screen, mind you, but on MTV in the form of the epic-length music video for Michael Jackson's smash hit Thriller. Landis' reputation was tarnished, however, following the tragic death of veteran actor Vic Morrow on the set of his segment of the anthology film The Twilight Zone. However, he would go on to direct another string of hits. He closed out the 80s with a triumvirate of popular comedies, Spies Like Us, The Three Amigos, and Coming to America, which reunited him with the still, at the time, mega-popular Eddie Murphy. The 90s, however, would not be nearly as smooth a ride. Landis' career was rocked by the critically reviled box office disappointment Oscar, followed soon after by Innocent Blood, which despite being marketed as the director of American Werewolf in London and Thriller's return to the horror genre, failed to drum up any significant box office. Not even another collaboration with Eddie Murphy could revive Landis' former muscle, as Beverly Hills Cop 3 was not the surefire hit that its predecessors had been. After another string of less-than-successful fare, including the Tom Arnold vehicle The Stupids, and a decidedly ill-advised Blues Brothers follow-up, sadly named Blues Brothers 2000, the 90s mercifully crashed to an end. John Landis would not release another feature-length film for 12 years, until 2010's Burke and Hare. With that, we'll begin with our standard, the good, the bad, and the ugly. We'll go with the ugliest person here. Gabriel. You bastard. Actually, if you look at our logo on the Facebook page, Gabriel's probably the prettiest of us.
Yeah, he probably is.
And I'm very jealous of that. Gabriel,
how dare you? I'm an adult.
Hector,
I'm really having trouble getting you
through Landis's entire filmography. What's your choice for the good?
John, I'm really having trouble hearing you tonight for some reason. You seem to go on and off, so...
I said, after watching this entire filmography, what would be your choice for the good?
It would be the Blues Brothers, definitely. It's a classic, and it's a classic for a reason. The dialogue is great. The improv is great. The great musical numbers. It's very funny. Great action scenes. Lots of energy. I mean, what else can I say about it? It's the Blues Brothers.
It's dark. We're wearing sunglasses. Hit it.
I mean, there's Henry Gibson as the leader of the Illinois Nazis. What more can you want?
I hate Illinois Nazis.
Yeah, that guy, to me, has always been one of filmdom's funniest scenes.
I hate Illinois
Those
Nazis.
Bums won their court date and they're marching today. What, who? A fucking Nazi party.
And it's got one of the best car crashes ever.
Actually, funny story. I'm a bit of an anime nerd. One of my absolute favorites from my youth, a little one called Riding Beam. Every single car chase and car crash in it was rotoscoped directly from the Blues Brothers.
It was good.
I'm a huge fan of Blues Brothers, too, and I think the thing, oddly enough, is this tiny little detail, which the movie sort of with these tiny little great details that people remember, but John Candy plays sort of a small role as this cop is after these guys. And they're at the big show, and he says, I'm going to get an orange whip. Orange whip? Orange whip? And the other two guys with him. I don't know what it is about the delivery of that.
Three orange whips?
I just find his...
And
it's just got so many tiny, tiny little moments like that that, I mean, you can relate it, and people won't really get why it's so funny.
Actually, I found Landis always had this thing about putting like old TV footage or old film footage in backgrounds. And there's the sequence when Jake and Elwood first, I can't remember who goes to the apartment building first, but the guy at the desk that, I don't want any trouble, is watching the same pro wrestling match. And if you look closely, it's the exact same sequence whenever the camera's it shows the inside of the booth. It's the scenes are different. He does different things in there, but it's always showing the exact same
part of the match.
The exact same part of the match.
I think that TV thing is maybe something from those directors from the 80s, because Joe Dante also does that a lot.
Yeah, yeah. And I can't remember, did the Blues Brothers have a See You Next Wednesday bit?
Oh, it must, somewhere. I can't recall exactly where.
Honestly believe that is in absolutely everything he has directed.
It came up, it was in the trailer for Schlock. So...
Oh, it's in Schlock. They go and see a movie that's called See You Next Wednesday.
Yeah, in the trailer, they're sort of announcing it as, you know, this major achievement in cinema history. And they say, first was Birth of a Nation, then Gone with the Wind, then 2001 A Space Odyssey, then Love Story, then See You Next Wednesday, and now Schlock.
And a thing that often comes up, too, is images like from King Kong or from like just an ape somewhere in there.
Yeah, he definitely has a monkey fixation. More on that later, though.
And a funny thing that I totally forgot about the Blues Brothers, I hadn't seen it in a long time, is Carrie Fisher as John Belushi's obsessive ex-girlfriend.
Well, actually, a couple years ago, I actually had the pleasure of meeting Dan Aykroyd. He was doing a autograph session at the local liquor stores when his when his brand of wine first hit the shelves. And
he's still on top.
No, I do have to say, like, the man had been sitting there, I think, at least 6 hours.
He'd been there a while.
Yeah,
and he was at another store.
He was at another store. He was doing it the entire day.
Yeah.
And apparently, you know, whenever, like, someone from his entourage or whatever, his manager would come over and tell him to wrap it up, he wouldn't leave until the last person in line got an autograph.
He wasn't asking for change, was he?
No. He was
okay. All right.
He was a pretty classy guy, I gotta say.
But, I mean, I really had to admit, I don't know, I can't even imagine how many copies of Ghostbusters and the Blues Brothers he signed that day.
Yeah.
He still, and we were towards the end of the lineup. I was working that day, and you only got to head over towards the end. And he still seemed really excited to sign my wife's copy of the Blues Brothers.
Yeah.
And
did he sign Crossroads after?
Yes, he did. He signed the Britney Spears movie Crossroads. I have no regrets, Dan Aykroyd.
You know, he was probably waiting there looking at this line of people thinking, you know, eventually somebody's going to come up with a VHS of Nothing But Trouble. He just had his fingers crossed.
God damn it, I got my VHS copy of Trouble.
Or maybe My Girl.
But, nope. Back on time, was just such an energetic, almost a really a perfect start to the style of comedies we got in the 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I'm not afraid to say, you know, I, as much of an Animal House fan as I am, I really do prefer the Blues Brothers.
Well, it's overall a better film. I mean, the Animal House, I find, is a little too based on skits, you know?
Yeah.
It's like sequences that don't really
It's a little self-indulgent.
Together. Yeah. But it's all...
You know, it's kind of funny, though, that you say that, because, I mean, the Blues Brothers could absolutely be described as... totally indulgent series of skits, but it does seem to hold together.
Yeah.
Very episodic movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it holds better together, than Animal House.
Yeah, but unlike Animal House, though, all the episodes of the Blues Brothers are awesome.
Yeah.
And it has an energy that's just driving it constantly.
Especially when you consider, man, that's between 2 and 2.5 hours long, and it doesn't feel like it at all.
I mean,
there's a special edition that adds something like, I think it's like an extra 20 minutes or so. And to be perfectly honest, you know, I'll put that one on. I'll think, oh, well, it's a bit long, but I don't notice the time going by any more slowly. Like, it just flies by.
And having, like, all those great legends performing helps, too. Like Ray Charles and James Brown and Aretha Franklin. I mean... Yeah, John Lee Hooker, I think, is in there, too.
John Lee Hooker's in it. In the theatrical cut, you only get, like, the first verse of the song, and then they move on to the Ray Charles scene. But the extended edition, you actually get the full-length sequence.
Yeah. It's almost, you know, it sort of strikes me that they conceived it a little bit like one, like a callback to sort of those, like, star-studded movies of the late 50s and early 60s, like it's a mad, 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 mad world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those sort of like cross-country, crazy racing kind of things. Or
Cannonball Run.
Yeah.
But, that's very much what it felt like. And honestly, I think that was that really was the plan all along, because really, how else were you going to get... Because the Blues Brothers on SNL wasn't a... it was popular, but I never found it to be a particularly funny skit, right?
Well, I mean, it wasn't particularly well established, really, was it, before the movie? Did they do a lot of...
I don't think so.
No, they just usually, you know, interacted with a musical guest or whatever, right? But it just... it can't... You know, they took what was basically a hollow concept and just through sheer insanity... managed to build a movie out of it.
Wasn't it really early in SNL's lifespan, too, though?
What, the Blues Brothers?
Blues Brothers? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Blues Brothers came out in 1980. It came out pretty much right after the original Not Ready for Primetime Players left.
Yeah, so it was... SNL didn't really have much of an identity established at that point anyway.
It wasn't... it was popular, but it wasn't as... it hadn't reached the heights it was going to.
It's easily the best movie ever made from an SNL skit. Easily. Mm-hmm.
As much as I love Wayne's World, yeah, it is definitely the best. Oh, you monster.
Wayne's World is my generation, man.
It's my generation too,
but Blues Brothers is a much better movie.
I just love how, not to digress into Wayne's World comparisons, but I just love how much
Wayne's World plays with the formula and breaks the fourth wall. It's actually a lot more clever than people give it credit for.
Oh, that's true.
Oh, it is. Absolutely.
But it's not as much, you know, plain fun driving energy as the Blues Brother is.
I don't disagree with you, Steve. All I'm saying is you're a horrible person.
Now, not to play devil's advocate, but seeing as Steve is a horrible person, Steve, what was your choice for the good?
Twilight Zone. No, I'm only kidding.
You monster.
No, my choice for good was also actually Blues Brothers. And I get a feeling we're probably all going to say Blues Brothers here.
Yeah, I mean, it's either that or American Werewolf, right?
Okay, well, Gabriel's going to do American Werewolf. No, he already picked Blues Brothers.
No, I picked Blues Brothers, but I mean, looking at Landis' filmography, I mean, you only have two choices for
I disagree, because actually my second favorite is Trading Places.
Oh.
More than American Werewolf.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, American Werewolf is my choice for ugly. I mean, what? No, I'm only kidding.
So, I love American Werewolf, but it has its share of problems, I think, that keep it working as well as it should.
Yeah, no, I like Blues. I like Blues Brothers for me is one of those, it's a movie that's infinitely quotable. And I mean, when I think I was probably 4 or 5 the first time I saw it, and I had a thing for car movies. I mean, I grew up with the Dukes of Hazzard and Knight Rider, so.
And Herbie Goes Bananas.
And Herbie Goes Bananas, and Once Again, which was awesome. It was a car thing, and early on, like when I was 4 or 5, I mean, I didn't get most of the humor, much the same as, you know, when I first saw DC Cab, I just saw taxi cabs fight terrorists or something.
Oh, we're not getting taxi into cabs, DC Cab right now.
People say fuck a whole lot.
But I mean, my parents, there was no censorship in my house. My parents, like, Dad would sit down and watch whatever with me. So, you know, Blues Brothers was something that I enjoyed.
Thank God a Serbian film only came out a few years.
But no, I enjoyed Blue Road. Like, when I was that age, I enjoyed the car crashes and whatnot, you know, and Dad just got a kick out of the humor and stuff. So it was something that we both enjoyed together, and I always kind of took to that movie. But as I got older, I will say I drifted away from it for a while, and when I came back to it at one point, I did find it kind of long. I found it kind of dull. But then it was a few years after that, I rediscovered it again on DVD, and it was kind of like, oh, yeah. You know, it had me hooked again. And I don't know if it was, you know, the first time I attempted to watch it in my adult life was in that brief little film school art snob kind of, you know, Quentin Tarantino is the most brilliant director ever because the instructor says so, you know, because everybody else thinks so. And I guess at that point I wasn't really into the whole the idea of nostalgia.
You're going to look
at the macchiato years.
Eat corn on the cob with no fucking teeth.
But when I got back to it, like when I came back to it after I'd kind of got that out of my system, I really enjoyed myself with it. And I mean, yeah, it is definitely, you know, I revisited some of Landis' stuff fairly recently. And, I mean, what I hadn't revisited, I'd already seen a couple of hundred times or so. So, you know. But yeah, Blues Brothers definitely rose to the top for me.
It's weird that you mentioned a nostalgia to me because I feel that the Blues Brothers is perhaps his most the movie that he made that stands out the most from its time, you know?
Yeah.
The rest feel very much from the 80s, but not the Blues Brothers.
Blues Brothers does have kind of I don't think it has a timeless feel. But it really has more of a 70s feel, and I think generally 70s movies age better anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Well, but it also has the advantage of deliberately evoking sort of 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s.
Yeah,
you know?
Sure.
So, there's that.
So, yeah, my choice, definitely Blues Brothers.
What about you, Andrew?
Well, I'm going to mix things up a bit, and I'm going to choose Blues Brothers. I mean, at this point, I'm just trying to think of, you know, what else I was going to say about it. But yeah, it's just nonstop. Oh God, I almost sounded like a blurb there. I'm not going to say nonstop.
Thrill ride.
Roller coaster.
No, you got to look at Joel Siegel and make a pun out of it.
It's the kind
Star Wars.
Of magic
it's the
you just don't see anymore.
You'll
now that I've gone blind.
It'll take your blues away.
Oh. Well, now I just want to die. No, it's great, just pure humor, music, and energy, and it seems like, well, I mean, it helps to me that it's one of the roles where Dan Aykroyd sort of disappears into it the most. I find, in an odd way, in some of his movies, he can be a bit too Dan Aykroyd-y, if that even makes sense.
Listen, if anyone's Dan Aykroyd-y, okay, it's Bill Paxton.
But, yeah, it's just got a great feel. It's like a perfect melding of John Landis's sensibility of sort of evoking all these nostalgic bits of his childhood, and this amazing concept of these two guys who are on a mission from God.
Mission from God. And look, guys, speaking back about, you know, Dan Aykroyd disappearing into it, I'm reasonably sure that he is Elwood Blues.
Yeah, and I was actually going to say that when you said it, Andrew. I was going to say, like, as opposed to basically he plays Elwood Blues in every other movie that he's in.
But, I mean, Elwood is much less, like, he's not, he's removed, you know? Like, he's a bit stiff.
Dan
more
Aykroyd
stiff
to
than,
me, like, real world Dan Aykroyd, I think, is...
Ghostbusters.
He's
yeah.
Brave from Ghostbusters.
Yeah, definitely.
You know? Especially once he goes off on his moderately insane UFO rants. But, yeah.
I
like
think of those as his stand-up comedy albums.
Yeah, so I like Blues Brothers, and I would recommend it to my friends.
So what about you, John? Did you also pick the Blues Brothers?
I had picked the Blues Brothers, but I'm pretty sure we've said everything we can possibly say, so just change things. I'm going to take another Landis favorite of mine. Let's talk about Trading Places for a few minutes.
Eggnog.
You don't understand me, Mr. Valentine. This is your house. These are your possessions. You'll only be stealing from yourself.
Very musical people, aren't they?
That, oh, man, I should have rewatched it. Randall, I saw it. I've only seen it once, like, a while ago. And I only remember, like, thinking it was okay, you know? Like, in my memory, I would have put it up against something like Brewster's Millions.
Yeah, and my thing with Trading Places, it's a funny movie, but the humor works in spite of the story, you know?
Yeah.
The plot's
kind
of hackneyed, and the script is pretty mediocre, but the humor plays well.
You can say the same thing about Stripes or anything before Ghostbusters.
Oh, I hated Stripes.
No, what works, what I found really worked with Trading Places, and, you know, I tried to go back and watch a bunch of old Eddie Murphy movies, and pretty much now I'm convinced the only stuff I really sticks with me anymore is his stand-up.
Dude, you didn't like The Golden Child?
Oh, I was just about to say something about The Golden Child.
I actually like that movie, yeah.
All right, Gabriel needs to watch Big Trouble in Little China 100 times.
Yes.
Oh, I've seen it a lot, and I still like Golden Child, but...
But
I have a problem.
What I always found with Trading Places is that, you know, it's before Eddie Murphy, the superstar, so
yeah.
He need to be center stage in the movie.
Yeah, this is true.
Right? He was. It worked the same way as 48 Hours, you know?
Mm.
Yeah.
I think it might have been better if he was center stage in the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he kind of carries it.
He did.
I don't know about that, actually.
Yeah?
I think I would actually, yeah, I'd argue against that pretty strongly.
Okay.
When Aykroyd has his... the sequence in it when he's dressed up as the drunken Santa Claus
is the greatest thing.
I forgot
of all
about
time.
The drunken Santa
and
Claus.
at the party, stuffing the smoked salmon into the jacket.
Yeah.
And I just love when he's finally stumbling out of the building with the pockets, like the drugs falling out of the pockets.
I forgot all about.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And he just turns around, and does it.
Yeah.
Okay, I know what I'm doing right after this podcast.
Yeah, you're like, Trading, Trading Places class? Has the Dan Aykroyd. It's Dan Aykroyd sort of it's what he can do, but so rarely allows himself to do.
Yeah.
I think.
I really found, you know, he kind of gets squirreled away into the, not really the straight man, but always the...
Sidekick.
The sidekick.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny because, you know, when he's allowed to go a little bit crazy in Trading Places, it's hilarious. But when they try to do the same thing in the late 80s in The Great Outdoors, it's just grating and horrible.
The Great Outdoors.
Mm-hmm.
What was the... Didn't they do, like, this Neighbors movie where he was the crazy neighbor?
Yeah.
I've never...
But that didn't work because you were trying to get John Belushi to play the straight man.
Yeah, right.
That was, what was the name of that movie?
Neighbors.
Neighbors. Yes.
You're getting confused with Continental Divide.
No. I'm that is exactly what I'm thinking.
But if we're talking about Trading Places, I mean, I have to mention the ape rape. I mean...
That's, you know what, that's the part of the movie that really, as soon as they get on, well, I don't want to say as soon as they get on the train, because I do enjoy the scenes featuring an exchange student from Cameroon, but
no more.
As soon as Jim Belushi shows up, the movie just totally loses me until they get off that train.
Yeah, and it's not even loses, it comes full stop. Because it crashes into a wall.
It crashes into Jim Belushi.
Yeah.
Who generally...
and Al Franken and stupid
and
costume jokes and...
When I went back and rewatched it before recording this, the sequence is only like 7 minutes long, but it feels like half an hour.
Yeah.
And you know what? That's really what I kind of remember from Trading Places is like when it falls, you know?
Yeah.
But it's such a small part of the movie.
It is. It really is.
And it picks itself up again once they get, you know, once they go to, you know, the exchange.
I mean, once you've seen Ape Rape, you can't erase that from your mind.
Oh,
I mean,
this is true.
I think it's the thing that stands out because it's just so ridiculous and out there and like offensive that. That's what sticks in your mind once you've seen the movie.
I'd be offended if it was the ape being raped. But given that it's the ape doing the raping, I'm okay with that.
Actually, I honestly wish that a guy in an ape suit would have run onto any sequence in Die Hard with Dwight T. Robinson. Or Dwayne T. Robinson.
Dwayne T. Robinson.
And just, like, started pancaking him in the ass. I'm not the one who just got booked.
Why does the phrase simian sodomy keep popping into my brain?
I'm not the one who just got butt fucked on national TV, Dwayne.
Oh, dear.
We're going to dark places.
Yeah. Actually, we're about. Well, no, first we got to do the bad. After that, we're going to go to some very dark places.
Oh, God.
So, I'm going to turn it around a little bit. Andrew, what was your pick for the bad?
For me, the bad, and again, as always, our disclaimer that the bad doesn't necessarily mean terrible. It's just something that doesn't quite work. For me, it was Innocent Blood. This is a movie that has a lot going for it, but it really feels like it wasn't... People didn't sit down and really think out the story and how to make it compelling and hold together. It's basically about, it's kind of an awkward setup. You've got some mobsters and an undercover cop, and then there's a vampire played by Anne Perriot, I believe.
Yes, from Nikita.
From Nikita. And Anthony LaPaglia is the protagonist. I don't know why it wasn't a box office smash.
you just said Anthony LaPaglia.
Yeah.
I know why it wasn't a box office.
I just can't figure it out.
it should have been like...
just shoving fistfuls of scenery and ham into his mouth.
Robert Loggia in this movie is... I love him in this movie. In many ways, it's an awful performance, but it's the kind of awful that is and you can't look away from.
It's
and
Gary Busey awful. You just you can't look away. It's mesmerizing.
And it's just completely.
He's got to know how bad it is, but I think he's trying to take it full circle. He's trying to make it so hammy and horrible that it becomes awesome.
Yeah. And, you know, it just, you think he's gone as high as he's going to go sort of on the register, and he just keeps going higher and higher and higher until he literally catches fire. Like, it's got a ton of really great character actors. It's got Don Rickles, it's got Luis Guzman, it's got Angela Bassett, it's got Marshall Bell, a.k.a. Kuwato, Kim Coates!
It's also got full female nudity in the first few seconds of the movie.
Hey!
Woo! Which is the, I think, this will sort of lead me to one of my main problems with it. That is sort of the, I think the reason that Ann Perio was hired.
Oh, for sure. it was either or Natasha Kinski, I bet.
Yeah, and actually, to be honest, every time I kept forgetting who was the star of it, and I kept thinking it was Natasha Kinski. but no, she's got this sort of, and I found this in Nikita too, she's got this quality of kind of like a pretty stupid 9-year-old girl who sort of like wanders around and looks at people and is like, oh, I don't know what's going on. and that I just find really, really irritating. And anytime she tries to deliver dialogue in English, it's completely unconvincing. Especially anytime, you know, there's some kind of colloquialism in the dialogue, and it's just like, you've got to be shitting me.
Like,
wait a second. Gabriel.
Yes.
Say what he just said.
Are you shitting me?
No, see, that's convincing.
Yeah, he
why weren't you in Innocent Blood?
Yeah, and I think we've established that you're the hottest one of us, so, you know, you could have walked around with no clothes on.
Dickhead.
But the funny thing is that I even lose some of her dialogue, and I'm used to people butchering English with French accents.
I thought you'd be more used to people botching French with English accents.
No, well, in Quebec, French people who try to speak English are very funny. Mm. I went to the market yesterday.
It's almost as good as Newfoundlanders trying to speak English.
What was that strange noise?
But getting back on the Innocent Blood, I kind of noticed Landis really, in the 80s, kind of depended on, you know, the improv strength of his actors. Hmm. Like, a lot of his movies, you know, you can tell he's just letting the comedians go wild. And Innocent Blood, there's not a whole lot of comedians in it.
No.
I mean, you've got guys like Chaz Palminteri and David Preval, who are pretty good at giving some, like, great spontaneous reactions and stuff.
And Guzman.
Yeah.
David Preval had me in The Sopranos when he bashed that coffee pot into that poor dude's face. And I
imagine if that was an Innocent Blood.
And Logia.
David Preval is one of my favorite parts of Monster Squad. He's in this tiny role as a pilot.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, I'm so depressed. And he's like, what are you worried about? He's like, this is great. He's like, yeah, I'm really happy. I love my job.
I'm betting Loja's performance is also all his creation. I mean, Loja is always pretty crazy, like in Lost Highway.
Yeah, he is an intense guy. And, you know, I think he is definitely one of the best parts of this movie. Regardless of whether you think his performance is good or bad, he's still one of the best parts. Because he brings a ton of energy to it. And you definitely want to see him die as horrible a death as possible.
Very you do. You really do.
Actually, I want to smash Lapaglia's face worse, but hey.
Yeah, I mean, that's
a normal reaction, Gabriel.
I mean, Lapaglia's got, you know, here's a movie involving basically mafia versus vampires versus mafia vampires. And Anthony LaPaglia is like, this is shitty.
Yeah, it should have been like Andy Garcia or something instead.
No, man, like Armand Asante at the height of his coke binge.
or like Bill Pullman, maybe.
You know, and but I also have to say one of the great things about this is it features one of the more fantastic arrays of Kim Coates grins.
Yeah.
You know, every time he's on screen, he just there's some reason for him to just like flash the shark grin.
And he does really have that wolfish grin down pat.
I never get tired of that.
We got
especially
for two.
Towards the end, I don't want to spoil too much, but towards the end, somebody walks into a room and he and another mobster are sitting casually on a couch with gore just smeared across their faces. And he's just kind of like, hey, what's up?
I had it on VHS way, way, way back. And the cassette inside was labeled Innocent Blood. But the case that it came in was actually labeled, it was like a French vampire in America or something like that.
It was a French vampire in New York, I think it was. Or something like it was. That was the international title.
Yeah, yeah.
And apparently John Landis got really pissed off at that because it was retitled. I'm sure there were enough challenges already, but it caused a bit of confusion when he was, you know, trying to promote this thing, and then it had all these different titles. But, yeah, troubled production, I think, to some degree. Great effects, though. The vampire effects are fantastic for, like, early 90s practical effects, and I think there are a few opticals in there, too.
Landis saw them pretty tight with Rick Baker, so...
Yeah, that's not.
Although Rick it wasn't Baker, Rick though. Baker doing it.
No?
No, or at least in the opening credits, the sort of special makeup effects were credited to someone else. And yeah. I was sort of anticipating Rick Baker's credit.
Was Tom Savini.
And
incidentally, one of the interesting cameos in Innocent Blood is Tom Savini.
Yeah,
as a photographer. So at first I was like, oh, well, maybe Tom Savini was involved. But actually, I don't think he was either. He was just sort of one of Landis's usual array of cameos.
And I have to mention that there's some nice camera work, too, in Innocent Blood.
That's something we should really talk about, because, I mean, Landis, unlike a lot of comedy directors, I think, has a really strong visual sensibility.
He definitely does. Definitely does.
He's got his own style that he's developed. It's sort of, it disappeared in the 90s. You know... It was in evidence in Oscar. It was definitely, I mean, Innocent Blood looks good, although I would say it's maybe less distinctively Landis-like. And then by the time we get to Burke and Hare, which, you know, not to rag on Burke and Hare too much, but I honestly wouldn't have identified it as a Landis movie if I didn't already know.
So, Steve, what was your choice for the bad?
My choice for the bad was Burke and Hare. I really, really enjoyed Burke and Hare. And for me, it was a film where the cast worked amazingly well. You know, like, well, of course you had Simon Pegg and Andy Serkis doing their thing, and they were really doing their thing. Like, you could tell they were really enjoying it. But then you had, like, Tom Wilkinson was in there and Tim Curry. And everybody was just kind of...
One of my redheaded goddesses.
Yeah. Everybody was just kind of... I think they were kind of going nuts with it a little bit, you know? Like, and I love the real... The slapstick almost feel of it. The way it kind of... The scene shifted and stuff like that. Like, it almost felt like a... It really felt like an old school comedy, you know? Like,
well, it definitely... It does not feel like any other sort of mainstream comedy being made in 2010.
No. It had this real zany... You know, like screwball feel to it.
Yeah.
Only incredibly dark. And I actually thought the visual style was really nice. It felt really textured. You know, there was
when I sort of made those comments, it's not that Burke and Hare doesn't look great, because it does.
Yeah, I think
it's just
fantastic.
It's got that sort of, it's got, you know, where usually I associate Landis with like really sort of intense use of shadows and like bold splashes of color and things, and this was sort of that really muted, kind of desaturated feel.
I didn't have a chance to see it, but one thing I noticed is Landis also like swift camera moves.
Yeah.
And dolly shots, too.
I love...
He's very... Oh, go ahead, Steve.
It had me at the sequence where the guys have the old man's body shoved in the barrel.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably the highest high point.
I roared at that. And
although, to be honest...
Was that, sir?
I was just going to say, I mean, you sort of mentioned one of the great things about it is the cast.
Yeah.
And I think it's possible I went in sort of with expectations a little too high. It was like, oh, it's the return of Landis. It's got Simon Pegg in it. And I kind of felt like, you know, a lot of the best comedic actors in it were sort of wasted. Like Simon Pegg, I didn't feel got the best material to work with. It had Bill Bailey in this tiny, tiny role sort of acting as the chorus for all of 2 seconds.
Yeah.
Jessica Hines from Spaced
was
there.
Yep.
She was really good in it, but it just kind of felt like it was the caliber of the cast was there, but they didn't have the level of material that they really needed to push it over the top.
And that was why it was my bad instead of my good. Like there are elements of it that I enjoy just as much as Blues Brothers, but it doesn't come together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the script is when it's focused on Burke and Hare and their exploits, you know, it's kind of, it works more or less. Like there's not really a whole lot to complain about there, but then you get into the whole, what was it? She's mounting a Shakespeare production and
which was totally out of place.
Yeah. And all that did was just kind of pad out the length and made the movie feel over long to me.
Mm-hmm.
It just didn't really have to be there. But, I mean, overall, it was just great to see Daisy on screen again.
Yeah.
You know, when I saw her in the movie, I had no idea she was in it. When I saw her, I was just like, oh my God! And I started shaking. Sarah's like, look who it is! Because the two of us are
but she's, space. But
she's not pouring,
she's
pouring
not the sweet
the
Daisy we know.
Oatmeal? Yeah. Yeah, she's pouring liquor into her bowl of oats. Which was amazing. But I mean, like, I love the cast. I loved every single scene that Tom Wilkinson was in. That guy is just amazing. He's absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
Mm. And overall, when it ended and stuff, I thought it came together. In the end, it kind of, like, it all kind of clicked pretty well. But, no, it wasn't his best film. Definitely not. But, I put it up there personally. Like, that's why it's my bad. You know, it's got its flaws. But overall, I found it a pretty enjoyable little romp.
What about you, Gabe? What's your bad on the list?
I have to go with another 80s classic that I mostly saw dubbed in French when I was young, and that is Coming to America. We were, Steve mentioned improv earlier, and this is perhaps the movie where I feel like Landis allowed the most improv, and that's
maybe a bit too much.
Yeah, too much improv.
Yeah.
And it's also the start of where Eddie Murphy, it's the first movie where he tried all the different makeups and characters that would later define his career with, like, Nutty Professor and all that shit.
It was kind of the first real, like, Eddie Murphy the superstar movie.
Yeah. And he plays a lot of characters. I mean, the makeups are amazing. I mean, he plays this old Jewish man, and you can never tell it's Eddie Murphy. But there's too many of them. There's too much business in the general plot. I mean, there's some funny moments, but I almost think that Arsenio Hall is funnier than Murphy in that film.
I have sort of very little patience for Eddie Murphy when he's, you know, the boss of the show.
Mm-hmm.
Because he definitely does. He needs someone to rein him in. So yeah, it's not my favorite.
And
I agree with that statement.
Yeah.
And like I saw it a lot when I was a kid, and seriously, watching it in English, it's not as funny.
Really, you have got to find for me the French clip of the Soul Glow commercial, because I'm dying to hear that.
I know I have it. I have the VHS in French here, but I can probably get you. You can probably get the DVD right somewhere. There has to be the French track on the DVD.
But the problem with that is I'd have to own Coming to America on DVD.
Oh, you can just rent it, or well, I'll try to find it for you. I can just rip that sequence out and send it to you. But yeah, I'll post that clip of some of the scenes from Coming to America in French, and they came from the More North Facebook page.
Yeah.
So listeners, check that out.
Yeah, no, for me it was Coming to America, again, like we were saying with Burke and Hare, just one of those movies where there's, you know, too many subplots that just pop up and then disappear without any resolution, just, you know, pad the screen time more and more. And I really don't think it was a terribly long movie.
No, but it feels like it.
Yeah, they wrote like 53 minutes worth of decent screenplay and then just let them go out and improv
like,
an hour.
Eddie will take care of the rest.
Yeah. All that stuff with the preacher could be cut out easily.
And anytime Louis Anderson is on camera, I want to punch something.
Which one is he?
Louis Anderson is the chunky fellow that works behind the fry cook at the restaurant.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And that entire bit with the whole McDonald's, McDougal's thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I love John Amos, but that didn't need to be in there at all either. It wasn't funny. It was like, you know, I could see when they're writing the movie at, it might be good for a giggle, but it's in the long run, it didn't work.
Wait, somebody wrote that script? I mean, I thought it was all done on the fly.
And yeah, this was really the start of, you know, Eddie Murphy wasn't the hip, young, sexy thing on the block anymore, and it was more Eddie Murphy, the comedy superstar.
Mm-hmm.
And thank God, you know, that only took a couple of years to hit its apex, and he kind of started to move downhill.
And at least there's James Earl Jones in the movie, so, I mean, he saves it a little.
I assumed you had sex with your bathers. I know I do. for me, this is a bit of a strange choice, considering how many times I basically wore out my VHS copy. My choice for the band, it had to be the Kentucky Fried Movie. I remember, I had very, very fond memories of it, and I was a huge Zucker fan. And, you know, I loved Airplane, I loved The Naked Gun. Top Secret, their 80s stuff in general. And I went back to it, and it's pretty much, you know, a half and half ratio. Half the stuff in the movie is just, you know, like Rex Kramer, Danger Seeker, and The Joy of Sex audio record. Like, the stuff is just hilarious beyond belief. Anytime you get to the Samuel L. Bronkowitz proudly presents, you know, it's like, I thought I was going to have to be hospitalized. I was laughing at her at it. But then there's other stuff in the movie that just drags on and on and on and on. You know, the half an hour long Fistful of Yen.
Yeah.
Was it when I was a kid? I mean, that was the peak of comedy. But it just, you go back to it now, and it's, I kept looking at my watch and looking at my watch, and you know, I remember this movie being a lot funnier.
But I still think Fistful of Yen is pretty funny. The thing is, I think it sucks air out. It's true, it sucks air out of the movie. It works on its own, but like, it shouldn't be in that movie. It's like a skit that should be on TV alone, away from the rest of the Kentucky Fried movie.
Yeah.
I was almost fortunate in the fact that I rented a DVD to watch this, and it ran into some serious skipping issues right when A Fistful of Yen started. And skipped basically exactly half an hour.
Nice.
So
actually, I think right after that is when you get into the zinc oxide in you, when that part is awesome.
Oh, I love zinc oxide.
But the thing about Fistful of Yen, I mean, it's so much like Enter the Dragon, and the way it's shot and everything is just very well made. And still, I think there's some funny stuff in there.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, no, I mean that's why it's my choice for bad. You know, there's good stuff in there, but it's just it's another example of you know, maybe Landis need to be reined in a little bit on it.
Mm-hmm. But is it just me, or it kind of, I felt like it lost steam basically after A Fistful of Yen.
I can definitely feel that. I mean, this is a movie that, you know, right from the beginning with the popcorn you're eating has been pissed in. Film at 11.
It is absolutely like the most of it's the most scattershot throw it at the screen and see what sticks movie I've ever seen.
And that was the whole point of it.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's just, you know, some of the stuff just doesn't stick.
Yeah. But I can respect that, you know, as a major fan of Kids in the Hall, I am perfectly willing to watch something where, you know, 3 out of 5 things work brilliantly and 2 are just awful.
That sounds about accurate, yep.
And actually, you know what? At least Kentucky Fried Movie and Kids in the Hall have a better record than Monty Python.
Yeah. People forget that.
And I think that's the appropriate statement to segue our way into the ugly. So, Steve,
we're
starting too busy
with
that
again?
iPad. What's your choice for the ugly?
The ugly. There's so much to choose from.
His entire 90s output.
I want to say Beverly Hills Cop 3.
Tom Arnold.
Yeah, I want to say Beverly Hills Cop 3. Because of that giant, stupid cartoon weapon.
Yeah.
And the fact that it was in an amusement park.
And Balky was in it.
And Balky was in it. I want to say Blues Brothers 2000 because, hey, Blues Brothers 2000. But
yeah.
I want to say The Stupids, but that would mean I would have had to have watched
Okay, so The Stupids is the one where he drives through the mall in the car, right? No, that's...
Yeah.
Every Tom Arnold movie is alike to me. Is The Stupid's the one with Arnold Schwarzenegger where he's lying about being a secret agent?
I wish.
Yeah, I gotta go with The Stupid's because, hey, Tom Arnold.
Yeah.
If for no other reason. I mean, it's... Anything with that guy is like dental surgery.
He's probably the... I don't know, but between he and Gilbert Gottfried, who'd be the more loathsome comedian
to
watch?
Now, Gilbert Gottfried is far below Tom Arnold in my mind. You know, I have to go back to your intro, and there was sort of this totally surreal moment as you were going through all the movies Landis had made, and you actually used the phrase, the Tom Arnold vehicle, The Stupids. And that just seemed so bizarre to me. The idea that somebody would decide, let's build a movie around Tom Arnold.
How bizarre.
See, I never saw anything that he did on TV, so I had no idea of who Arnold was until I saw like True Lies. So I have no hate for him.
And yeah, he's actually
like,
fantastic in True Lies.
And then the only other movie I've seen him was Happy Endings, and he was great in that movie.
Again, your questionable French taste puzzles us all.
Well, did you see Happy Endings?
No.
See?
I trust you.
It's from the guy who made The Opposite of Sex.
I'm currently living out west. I'm supposed to have some kind of baseless hostility towards Quebec.
Oh, okay.
I'm just trying to live up to the cultural stereotype.
I thought that was supposed to be us.
I think it's everybody.
I think everybody hates Quebec. Isn't that the thing, though?
It's a hate sandwich.
And everybody else in Quebec hates Montreal.
Yeah, and we all hate everybody else, so it's fine.
It's kind of an equal opportunity thing.
We're such a friendly country.
How about you, Gabe? What is your choice for the ugly?
Definitely Blues Brothers 2000. Because, I mean, I could have gone with Beverly Hills Cop 3, but at least it doesn't crap on something that's really great to begin with.
Yeah, those
because,
movies,
yeah, Beverly Hills Cop has never been good. I'd like to put that out there.
Soundtracks with movies attached to them, that's all.
But Blues Brothers 2000 takes a giant crap on a movie I love, and it adds a kid in the mix for some reason, and it tries to recreate the car crash. And that's just, oh, man, it just doesn't stop.
It's I forgot about the kid as if, you know, like, a super hard R-rated comedy was, you know, needs to be made family-friendly.
But yeah. I think
it's
for
the
me,
RoboCop 3 effect.
The point where I lost it was really the car crash. I mean, it's like the Simpsons episodes where Sideshow Bob steps on the rake, but like ranked up to 1,000. It just never stops.
That kid was almost Macaulay Culkin.
Wow.
Let that sink in for a minute.
Ouch.
The kid in Blues Brothers 2000 was almost cast as Macaulay Culkin was almost cast.
Okay, it could have been worse. Because the kid actually plays harmonica and stuff, I think.
At least he's dubbed over convincingly.
I didn't feel like forcing myself to watch it.
I can't believe no one's mentioned Joe Morton.
Well, I just wanted to spare, you know, his reputation, to be honest. I was hoping we could get through this whole thing without reminding everyone that he'd been in the middle of this thing. Poor Joe Morton. He deserves better.
And isn't there, like, a really bad segment in, like, a Louisiana whorehouse, too? Or something like that? I don't know. I don't want to remember anything about that film.
It's like a fever dream.
Moving on to happier pastures. Andrew, what was your ugly?
My ugly?
Blues Brothers 2000.
Yeah, I'm really tempted to go there. But actually, well, now I kind of feel like I have to. I was going to say Oscar. But right before, while I was waiting for certain people to make themselves available to record this, I started rewatching Oscar on YouTube, and I found myself quite enjoying
it. It's not a terrible movie. I don't understand.
Yeah, so it doesn't fit the ugly category.
No, it's a bad for sure. I mean, let's not go crazy here. It's definitely a bad.
And I had been already. I mean, I hadn't seen it in years, so it was apparently unwise for me to assume that it was terrible because I had really hostile memories of that movie. Like the first time I saw it, I just hated it intensely. and you know, I think probably one of the reasons that was is because when I first saw it, I had not seen very many old movies. And now that I've come back to it years later, I can see all the ways in which it not just sort of calls back to the 30s sort of gangster aesthetic, but everything from all of the performances, the delivery of the dialogue, the way the movie is structured, sort of this sort of running up and down stairs in one house during a single morning, it really feels like a late 30s, early 40s screwball comedy.
It does. And you know what? Like, I know a lot of the hate that this movie got was directed at him, but man, Stallone is really trying his damnedest in this movie.
Oh, he's charismatic fucker, man.
Yeah, he's really kind of he's giving it his all.
Well, as much bad as he gets, I think Stallone's actually pretty good in comedy when he wants to be.
Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, Demolition Man, come on.
Yeah.
I think even he makes fun of this movie endlessly himself. But even Stop or My Mom Will Shoot, you know, he's in on the joke the whole time.
Yeah.
You know?
And, of course, Tango and Cash.
Oh, Rambo is a pussy.
No, you know, but listen, I will still hold up the Tango and Cash as one of the unsung action classics of the 1980s.
No, it wasn't. The only thing that movie had going for it was Stallone.
Oh, no, I have
Tango
to...
Tango and Cash is one of the unsung action classics of the 80s. Which was then partially taped over and had commercial breaks. And then somebody kind of re-edited it together so it sort of made sense. That's how it feels to me.
And it's probably the nicest Kurt Russell's hair has ever looked.
No.
Something wrong.
Oscar. But yeah, Oscar, I'm kind of cheating here because I'm not treating it as an ugly. But it's got a lot going for it. It's cheesy and it's, you know, there's a lot of mugging to the camera and it's pretty hokey. But at the same time, it's sort of charming in that way that it really is evoking that old way of making movies. And especially, the character of Aldo, played by, Peter Reigart, he nails the mannerisms and the delivery of a contract studio C-list character actor who popped up in tiny, tiny roles as, like, some kind of wacky gangster heavy in, like, the 40s. Like, he totally seems like the real deal as opposed to a 90s actor pretending to do that.
Yeah.
But would you really, like... Since you're not totally destroying it, would you say still say it's worse than like Innocent Blood, or?
I'd say it's you know what, I would say it's worse than Innocent Blood in that maybe just because I'm a bit of a sucker for horror and any sort of like cool visual horror stuff, and there's a lot of cool stuff in Innocent Blood despite its problems.
I'd say it's not as good as Innocent Blood because it has 100% less Kim Coates.
100% less Kim Coates and 100% more Tim Curry.
Yeah, yeah, there's that.
But it also has William Atherton in it.
Which is pretty badass.
What a dick.
Eat it, Harvey.
Does he play a heel in it? I don't remember.
There's only one movie he didn't play a heel.
Sugarland Express.
Yeah, he's a snobby, waspish kind of banker guy. So yeah, basically what you'd expect from William Atherton.
Heel.
Yeah.
Well, you know, since I'm surrounded by cowards this evening, I'm just gonna go and do it. My ugly's got to be Beverly Hills Cop 3. I didn't hate on Beverly Hills Cop 2 enough when we did Tony Scott. So I'm gonna continue the Eddie Murphy rage train.
I just like to say the only reason I wasn't just totally banging on Beverly Hills Cop 3 is because I actually think it's the best of the three. But continue.
Who's the crazy Frenchman now?
Hey, I didn't say I think it's good. That just tells you what I think of the first and the second.
Yeah. But I got to go with it. Not only because, you know, you read the horror stories about how Eddie Murphy was trying to capture some of the serious black actor of Denzel Washington, which, you know, he's completely incapable of.
Especially in a sequel to Beverly Hills
Cop. In a sequel to Beverly Hills Cop. Landis has said in interviews that, you know, the movie doesn't really have a script. He always says the worst script he ever read was the original Beverly Hills Cop. That's just his way kind of alluding to how strong he felt about Eddie Murphy's improv abilities in the early 80s. And in Beverly Hills Cop 3, he just, you know, he wasn't game for it. But beyond that, you look at Beverly Hills Cop 3, and Landis has shown that, you know, we talked about it a little bit earlier. He does have a decent visual eye. You know, you saw some flashes of brilliance in American Werewolf in London, and again in Innocent Blood. I mean, even in the video for Thriller, right? There's some good stuff in there. Beverly Hills Cop 3 has an action sequence on a roller coaster. That should be fucking amazing. That is something to me that, if done properly, should be amazing. And in Beverly Hills Cop 3, what you get is Steve's reaction. Do it again.
You know, Beverly Hills Cop 3, to me, like, the whole aesthetic of it, it really made me think I was watching, like, an old episode of Matlock. Like, that's how it feels to me when I watch that movie.
Matlock, you gonna keep taking a coffee break? That guy's shot.
And part of that is, I think, the guy who plays the, like, the main heavy, I forget his name, the actor, but
he was probably on super, like, Matlock.
What's that?
He was probably on an episode of Matlock.
Yeah, well, he's that sort of, like, early 90s, just in the most middle-of-the-road, bland TV stuff kind of thing. And it feels like, the whole movie feels like that. Plus Judge Reinhold.
I've looked everything from Beverly Hills Cop 3 that I could, besides that stupid gun, and, like, the action sequence on the Ferris wheel, and Bronson Pinchot showing up again. And that's all I remember.
But it does, again, like, many Landis definitely have a pretty solid lineup of cameos.
But, I mean, he's definitely not flying high on the wings of his dreams in that movie.
No.
It feels... I remember being totally bored by it. Like, it's totally flat.
And I think that's why it's my favorite of the three movies, because I was just thoroughly bored instead of actively angry at my people.
This will tell you something. I can remember that was – my dad went down and rented a couple of tapes for me when I got sick. And I remember – I can't remember what the third one was, because we had a video store around. You know, you could rent three movies for 4 days for $5. And I can't remember the third one, but I remember he got Beverly Hills Cop 3 and Drop Zone. I think the third one might have been Nick of Time.
Ooh.
Yeah, Beverly Hills Cop 3 was so bad that it made Drop Zone seem awesome.
Yeah. I was just going to say, like, it's kind of amazing when you get three movies and Drop Zone is
the best
runaway leader.
Yeah.
But what was the other free jumping film in that?
Terminal Velocity.
Yeah, right.
It's
like same one. Charlie Sheen, man.
Yeah.
And he had an awesome, awesome hero name. I can't remember his last name, but his first name was Ditch.
Ditch.
They combined Dick and Rich to get Ditch.
Okay, I have to look that up.
And that was a. Going off topic now, the rage train has gone off the tracks. That was another one for me. Like, I made a joke on the Facebook page the other day about the Rube Goldberg device that kills John Malkovich at the end of Con Air, and how it's so elaborate and stupid and awesome, it deserves a better movie. The end of Terminal Velocity has another, which should be, you know, a Mazeballs villain death, but the way it's shot, it just looks like absolute shit.
I remember Terminal Velocity several times.
And thinking it was better than Drop Zone?
I don't remember ever seeing Drop Zone. That's the Wesley Snipes one, right?
Yeah.
I think I've ever actually seen it.
Great.
Richard Ditch Brody.
Ditch Brody. Yes.
And Natasha Kinski plays Krista Moldova.
She was mega hot. She was hot as rocks in that movie, though.
She's always hot.
I just want to bring us back to Beverly Hills Cop 3 for 1 second. Because
what do we have to, Dad?
All I want to say is, you know, it's they came from the north, so we got to call out our awesome Canadian character actors when they show up. And this movie has Stephen McHattie in it, who is one of the ultimate badasses. And again, he is surrounded by a movie unworthy of him.
Unfortunately, it also has Hector Elizondo.
Is Stephen McHattie the guy from Watchmen and 300?
Yeah.
Yeah, yes. Like 300. I couldn't believe in 300. The guy looks like he's 70 years old, and he's still fucking ripped.
Yeah. Stephen McHattie is like... We want to get Lance Henriksen, but for some unimaginable reason, he's decided to draw the line at our movie. So we're going to get Stephen McHattie instead.
If we're going to mention Canadian people cameos, I have to mention David Cronenberg showing up in Into the Night.
This is true.
Yeah.
That's because David Cronenberg thought he was directing Into the Night.
He's like, oh, yeah, Jeff Goldblum. I hear we're working together. Showed up on the wrong set. Where are the telepods?
Some interesting cameos in Beverly Hills Cop 3.
Go on.
You had Joe Dante. You had Ray Harryhausen, who also popped up in Burke and Hare.
And
Ray Harryhausen's still like alive?
Yep.
Wow.
And you had George Lucas.
Well, Spielberg's in Blues Brothers.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And John Singleton.
Yeah, John Singleton.
That's a Landis trademark, putting directors in roles.
Yeah.
Barbet Schroeder, Arthur Hiller, Peter Medak. So lots of, directors people may not know, not be familiar with, but they're pretty significant figures.
There was Paul Mazursky and Roger Vadim in Into the Night.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, Beverly Hills Cop 3 also has the Annihilator 2000.
Ugh.
Is that the cartoon gun?
Yeah.
It's deep!
Shouldn't it be called the BFG 2000?
Oh, dear.
And it's not like we're not fans of huge, crazy guns in movies. Like, you remember the split-second gun?
Oh, the split-second gun was amazing.
Or the gun in The Fifth Element.
Or the gun from Deep Rising.
I think those were the same.
We really have to start talking about a new movie. It's making me want to wander off and fall asleep in a snowdrift.
Okay, so before Andrew commits Shining suicide, boys, let's close off. You got any thoughts on John Landis?
Who?
We'll start with Andrew.
We've pretty much covered it, but I think he's a guy who probably doesn't get as much respect as he should, largely because the last 20 years have really not been kind. the late 70s, right through the 80s, he was a really, really solid director, and I would like to see him get at least one more really solid movie.
I mean, guys, that's undeniable dies. String of hits in the 80s.
Mm.
Right, the only thing I think he directed that wasn't a moneymaker was Into the Night.
Which is really good.
It's good, but I mean, it's a bit of a curiosity, right?
Yeah, but it was a surprise in my viewing. I didn't think I would enjoy it that much, but it's really fun.
What about you, Gabe? What do you think about Landis?
I don't really have to add much, but I think we forgot to maybe to mention a little bit of. I think that hurts him a little, I think, is that he likes stupid humor a lot. You know, like slapstick and dumb jokes and dumb visual gags. Sometimes those are really funny, but sometimes they just fall flat. But,
he doesn't always have the discipline to realize when he should maybe have one less gorilla rape.
Yeah.
I was just about to mention schlock. You know, the whole concept of schlock is a small town being terrorized by this gorilla monster, which was John Landis in a gorilla suit. And the whole joke of the movie is he's supposedly terrorizing the town, and no one in the town is afraid of him.
Mm.
Right? That to me, that's, you know, it's kind of like, what was that stupid Jack Black TV show that didn't get picked up? Heat Vision and,
I don't remember.
Oh, Heat Vision and... Was it Heat Vision and Jack, or was it something else? Heat Vision and... Yeah.
No, but it's like that. It's just one of these things you're sitting there. You thought this was a good idea? you didn't have... Your friends were too afraid to tell you, man, you know, you got some good material, but no, just don't.
But
it's worth saying that John Landis, along with Joe Dante, is one of the main guys who does Trailers from Hell, which is a really good website, which is basically... trailers for all these old schlocky movies, and you can watch the trailers or watch commentary from various filmmakers over it. So he has a real affection for old, trashy stuff.
You can feel it in schlock. I mean, it's definitely there. And
it's all that's there.
I think he also has, usually he had a really good sense of timing to add to his visual thriller, and most of his good movies are... Definitely high energy, if a little bit uneven. I think that, I mean, one thing that I've got to give to is American Werewolf in London. I mean, that beginning, it feels like a genuine horror movie, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think
it'd be nice to see him try his hand at a straight up horror movie with very little humor. I think he could probably pull it off.
I think my opinion of him, he's a grade A visualist. You know, he really knows how to move a camera, how to frame a scene, and on top of that, he's got a real, you know, a joy de vivre. He really seems to enjoy what he's doing. You know, like, it's easy to get into the headspace of his movies, even when they're terrible. You know, he has that way of kind of. I get, you know, it feels enthusiastic, and you want to get carried up in that enthusiasm. You know, like, it always feels like he's going forward all guns, and you really want to go along for the ride, even if it's a terrible, terrible ride, you know?
Yeah.
And that's pretty much what I was going to say. You know, before I started doing my research for this episode, I had no idea how bad the 90s were for Landis.
They were pretty horrible.
Yeah. You know, like, he opens up with another Michael Jackson music video, and then it's all downhill from there.
Mm.
Did any of you see his Masters of Horror episodes?
I did.
Yeah.
How are they?
They were pretty good.
Yeah, well...
I tried to track them down. I couldn't, but...
The one he did with George Wendt was actually Family.
Yeah.
Was actually really, really funny. Right? And it's got, it's kind of got that whole John Landis black comedy twinkle in the eye type deal. You can tell this was something he was having a ball with. Right? And it's,
he's not restricted, Masters of Horror,
45 minutes to an hour long. He didn't have enough room to really go crazy with it. So it doesn't suffer that pitfall.
I find with Masters of Horror in particular, I think a lot of the directors involved were kind of
not masters.
Yeah, well, for starters, yeah. I mean, you know, guys like Stuart Gordon and all these guys. It's just you know.
The first season of that show should have been called John Carpenter and the other guys.
Yeah, but no, it's like a lot of the guys were, you know, guy like it wasn't Masters of Horror. You know, you didn't really have the big names, and the guys like even a lot of the guys who were involved, they did have a few horror breakouts and stuff, but.
Except for, like, Argento.
Yeah, oh, God. But I got to say, Landis's episodes definitely stood out.
What was his own with the Deer Woman?
The Deer Woman was great.
Absolutely hilarious.
Yeah, the Deer Woman was great.
I still love the when Buddy's trying to figure out in his head, he's thinking about the crime scenes, and every time he clicks back up, that's stupid.
Anybody else got anything left over to say about Mr. Landis?
Right.
I fell asleep.
You're not in a snowdrift, though, are you?
No, I'm warm.
So, on this note, I guess we'll say see you next Wednesday when we discuss director Stuart Gordon, maker of...
That deserves a slow clap.
Don't we need to speed up and then everyone starts clapping and then we stand up?
Maybe.
We are Marshall.
How long have you been polishing that gem this whole episode, haven't you, Gabe?
Oh, totally.
Totally. And, like, I'm pissed off. Like, I was, as soon as he said it, the first thing in my head is, motherfucker.
I was actually, no, I won't even get into it. I'm going to leave it. It's going to be a fun episode.
So, director of Reanimator and... amongst others.
Dagon!
It's sure to be a pretty fun episode, as I'll probably be the only one defending him.
The rest of us will all be intestinated.
I'm having batshy flashbacks.
So you better clear the tracks. Next Wednesday, Rage Train is coming through.
Good night.
With that, we are out of here.